everybody's going to die. Can that inspire us to be kind to each other, particularly to be kind to ourselves, to forgive ourselves, to realize that we are loved, we are love.
Hello and welcome to the Daily Helping with Dr. Richard Schuster. Food for the brain, knowledge from the experts, tools to win at life. I'm your host, Dr. Richard. Whoever you are, wherever you're from, and whatever you do, this is the show that is going to help you become the best version of yourself. Each episode, you will hear from some of the most amazing, talented, and successful people on the planet who followed their passions and strive to help others. Join our movement to get 1 million people each day to commit acts of kindness for others. Together, we're going to make the world a better place. Are you ready? Because it's time for your Daily Helping. Thanks for tuning into this episode of the Daily Helping Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Richard, and our guest today is truly brilliant. His name is Ramdev Dale Borglum, and he is the author of How to Live So You Can Die Without Fear, which is available everywhere tomorrow. He's the executive director as well of the Living Dying Project, a pioneering figure in the conscious dying movement. He has spent decades helping individuals face death and face life with greater awareness and has collaborated with leaders in the field, including Ram Dass, Stefan Levine, and Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. Drawing on his background as a mathematician, meditation teacher, lover of God, and devoted practitioner of both Eastern and Western healing traditions, Dale offers a uniquely practical and accessible map to the healing path. Dale, welcome to the Daily Helping. This is such an important topic. Thank you for joining us on the show today.
So glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So you've been in this movement for decades. I know people like Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and Ram Dass were pioneers in this field, but your background is very interesting because you really do combine a lot of things that at face would seem at odds with each other, right? Mathematics, meditation, Eastern traditions, Western traditions, you kind of blended it all together. So what I'd love to do first is jump in the Dale Borglum time machine. And I'd love for you to share with us about these seminal moments, these pieces on the timeline that put you on the path you're on today, helping so many people in the world.
Well, it's a long story, of course. And I was getting a PhD in math at Stanford back in the 60s when the consciousness explosion was exploding. And as luck or karma would have it, whenever Ram Dass came to Northern California, he'd stay right across the street from me. So we got to be friends. He stayed with a mutual friend. He had been interested in conscious dying. He had been friends with a guy named Aldous Huxley, who wrote a book called Island about, it was a novel about a utopian community. And at this utopian community, they had a center for conscious dying. And what conscious dying is like conscious living. It's like, how present, loving, open can you be? Can you apply the traditional wisdom of Christianity, Hinduism, Buddhism, whatever, to end-of-life issues? And in those days, death was really denied and avoided as a topic of conversation in our country. So Ram Dass, in his effort to talk about this, was receiving very little positive feedback. He kind of gave up. And then Elizabeth Kubler-Ross showed up, and she started talking about not conscious dying, but dying itself. And that opened the door, if you will. And at one point, Ram Dass was teaching a workshop in Rhode Island. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross came as a student. Stephen Levine was the meditation teacher. Stephen and Elizabeth hit it off. She invited him to become the meditation teacher at her retreats. And then they parted ways amicably, and Stephen Ram Dass and I started working together. So that was the late 70s, early 80s. It's really the beginning of, can we apply devotion and compassion and meditation to end-of-life issues, caregiving, grief? And it really was transformative. I mean, it was in a way the place where the deepest fear in our society existed then, and it's the place where the deepest fear exists now, right? So we moved to Santa Fe. I became the founder and director of this place called the Dying Center, where people came to die consciously, the first place in the Western world to promote this. And since then, I have moved back to Northern California. We don't have a physical place, but I've trained 150 volunteers around the world who offer one-to-one free of charge conscious support to people who are dying. Now, a couple of points, though. You probably think that mostly what I'm about, this organization, the Living Dying Project, is about, is helping individual people die or grieve or be a caregiver. And that may be the most obvious takeaway, but really, the name of the project is Living/Dying Project. It's about that slash. It's not about dying so much. It's about how the way we live determines how we die. And the fact we're going to die hopefully can inform how we're living, right? So to me, as time has gone on, it becomes more and more clear that this work is about healing. It's not about dying. Everybody wants to heal. Everybody wants to be whole. No matter what your politics, you know, matter how religious or spiritual you are or aren't, everybody wants to be happier. Everybody wants to suffer less. Everybody wants to be more in touch with their wholeness, even if they don't know that consciously. And the fact that we're dying, eventually, everybody can motivate people to look at that truth. In Buddhism, they have these things called the mind-turning truths. Truths that turn your mind toward waking up. And the first one is that you're going to die and you don't know when. Completely obvious intellectually. But right, if you and I really knew that, Dr. Richard, if we really knew that we weren't sure we were going to be alive at the end of this podcast, how much more vulnerable and loving and intensely present would we be, rather than thinking, okay, I got to get this podcast done, and then it's on to the meeting with my business manager, and then I got to do this, and then I got to do that. But like, here we are, we're going to die, boom, right? So one of my first meditation teachers said that until you come into intimate contact with death, your spiritual life will have the quality of you being a dilettante. I want to wake up. I want to be free of suffering. I want to help other people be free of suffering. And for me, then, this work with dying, and not necessarily, well, certainly that's part of it, being at the bedside of this individual, but helping people individually and collectively deal with fear of death is, I think, for almost everybody, one of the core issues that keeps us from trusting the vulnerability of the heart, from being willing to connect with other people. I mean, when we look at what's going on in our country right now, political divisiveness, social inequality, environmental degradation, on and on and on, right? We can throw some money over here, Amnesty International, and then the blood starts spurting out over here, and you got to run over there to homelessness and over there for hunger. But if you really deal with fear of death, that's at the root of all this other stuff. If you and I really know that we're going to die and that we can begin to inhabit both our humanity and our infinite nature at the same time, right? So my view is that you and I and everybody are twofold beings. We're human beings who live and die and have lovely days and difficult days, and there's this like spiritual or infinite being that's always perfect. One of my other spiritual teachers, Suzuki Roshi, said to his students, "You're all perfect, but there's still some room for improvement." Right? So can we keep both of those things alive, awake at the same time? That we're perfect, God loves us just the way we are, and there's work to do here. Working with our fear, our guilt, our shame, our grief. And the fact we're dying then to me is the inspiration, the motivation to doing this work. And certainly, on the other hand, it's such a a blessing, such an honor to be included with someone's dying process. It can be the most remarkable, transformative time in somebody's life, where people are essentialized. It's not about how good you're looking, are you having a good hair day, or how much money you have. It's like, what is important? How much can we love? So in the book I wrote, it's really, there's kind of three parts of it. The first part is, my editor said, you've got to put in memoir stuff so people will want to pay attention to you. So I talk about being a mathematician and going to India and meeting Maharaji and Ram Dass and on and on and on. But the second part is the spiritual path. And in your introduction, you kind of pointed out, I have all these different kinds of backgrounds from the East and the West and from science. And what's really fascinating to me is that what depth psychology says in terms of stages of early childhood development, the awakening of the chakras, the 12-step healing programs, addiction programs, the historical evolution of Buddhism, they're all saying the same thing. There's a path. And if we see that clearly enough, it helps us see where we are and work with this underlying fear. And then the last part of the book is applying that to dying and grieving and caregiving.
I want to spend a little bit of time with part two. In particular, and I don't know what the statistics are exactly, but I know they're increasing. There are a larger number of people that, younger people in particular, who have rejected organized religion. Maybe not spirituality. Maybe in some instances they have rejected even the notion of spirituality. So for someone who identifies themselves as either a religious or, you know, not spiritual, doesn't believe in higher powers, whatnot, what would you say to that person, and how would this book help them?
Well, it all begins with, what do you really want? The most important thing is finding the most important thing. If you want to be free of suffering, if you want to have a happier life, better relationships, then how do you go about doing that? Some people do this through meditation or religion. Certainly, religion has a bad taste for many people. I grew up as a Lutheran, which is basically Catholicism without the beauty, all the guilt, none of the ritual, if you will, coming from the Midwest. So you don't have to be a meditator. You don't have to think about God as a separate thing, if you will, but can we work with being more present, being in our bodies rather than being lost in our heads, being aware of how connected do I feel to the people around me, seeing the beauty around me? And in the book, there are attitudes and practices to deepen those qualities. And I tried to write a book. It's not another Buddhist book about dying. There's too many of those out there already. The shelves are groaning. But the fact you're going to die, does that inspire you to want to wake up? And how do you want to go about doing that? Are there some tools? My view is that a lot of Western approach to spirituality has some basic problems. A lot of the stuff that came from the East was written by and for Asian people thousands of years ago who were walking around barefoot and didn't have iPhones, right? They were grounded. They were connected to the earth. Most Westerners aren't. Most people are up in their heads a lot of the time, and particularly if something is challenging in their lives in the moment, then how can we fix it? How can we solve it? Rather than trusting the wisdom of the body, trusting being down in the belly, being down in the heart. How is it that a martial arts master, a tiny, frail, elderly martial arts master, can defeat a big hulking novice? Because he or she isn't doing it, right? It's the chi, the energy of the universe flowing through that's in the relationship there. And to the extent we're caught, I've got to do this, the world out there is very complex, AI, politics, on and on and on. The mind boggles. It's like, I've been on this planet a long time. I've never seen anything like this. And I have a really hard time understanding or even feeling how somebody who doesn't have some practices in their life, some faith in or movement towards something larger than the mind, can deal with what's going on without getting really depressed by it. And believe it or not, I've got a son who's 23 years old, who just graduated from Yale Divinity School 3 days ago, right? 23 years old, Yale Divinity School. He's having a hard time finding a job, right? And it's a tough time to be going out into life as an adult right now. What's going to happen? It's so unknown. It's so uncertain. Uncertainty doesn't necessarily create anxiety. How can we learn to be comfortable with uncertainty, right? So the book works with those questions as well. I run this nonprofit called the Living Dying Project. We have free of charge information. It's the most complete website on the internet about conscious dying, guided meditations, lectures. I have a podcast. I do have a podcast, but I have a group every other Saturday with 1,200 people. Very intimate. Actually, it is. It's a very sweet group of people. And in some very fundamental way, the more challenging and difficult and the external world is, maybe that inspires people to want to wake up, to look at that underlying fear. How much of our lives, how much of our activity, our speech, our action, our thought is motivated by anxiety and contraction rather than openness and trust, right? I mean, is the fact you're going to die and you don't know when, is that scary or is that inspirational? Right? And that's something we each have to ask ourselves again and again and again.
Hey guys, Dr. Richard here. For the past 7 years, I've been privileged to bring you incredible guests who are changing the world and can help you become the best version of yourself. I'm really excited to share with you a new quiz that I created based on my clinical training that will curate for you a custom list of my top episodes and actionable strategies to help you wherever you are on your journey. All you need to do is go to drrichardschuster.com to take it, and it's 100% free. You'll be taking the next step on the journey to unlocking the power of you, and I can't wait to see where you'll go. I imagine it probably shifts for people depending on what's going on in their world at the time. And something else I was thinking about, Dale, and I love that we're having these conversations because you're talking about chi and chakras, but you're a PhD mathematician, right? So again, you have these really unique high level East and West perspectives. A lot of what you're talking about feels connected to an internal versus an external locus of control. That is, if somebody feels that they have governance over their life, that person probably would have less anxiety around the end whenever it comes. And somebody who feels as they're floating through life on a river and the current is crazy and they have no control over anything.
Well, I don't know about that, Dr. Richard.
All right, great. So tell me your thoughts.
I would say it's more that people who are comfortable in realizing that their life is out of control have an easier time. When you think you've got to be in control, good luck.
Well, that's interesting because the data, and the data goes back 50 plus years, shows, generally speaking, people that have a greater internal locus of control have less emotional distress than those that don't. So this is like a paradigm shift, right? Because it's turning that thought process on its head.
Well, I would agree that if you're so poor that you don't know how you're going to feed yourself, or if your car's going to make it to work, or if you're concerned the world's going to blow up tomorrow, that it's not very good for your sense of well-being. But what I'm saying is, assuming we have a baseline of well-being, that you have enough food to eat, enough money to pay the utility bill, your car's going to get you to work, you're not going to get fired tomorrow, probably, then it is surrendering, letting go into the next moment. I'm a guy. I'm a recovering mathematician. And for the longest time, I felt, being this person with male genitalia, that my work was, I'm here to do something. I'm here to fix you, right? And I'm here to meditate and get better myself. And the more I've done this, it seems like it's more about surrendering and receiving grace moment to moment to moment. That's always there, right? And it doesn't mean it's always fun. It doesn't mean it's always pleasant. Ramana says this great metaphor. He says, spiritual life is like jumping out of an airplane and partway down realizing you don't have on a parachute. And then a little further the way down, realize it's okay because there's no ground, that you're getting comfortable in free fall. That's no control. You're just, it's free fall through life, but you have faith that there's no ground, that there's not rocks coming up as you're falling through space, right? So, I mean, I think what you're saying and I'm saying aren't really contradictory. They're kind of at different levels of consciousness, if you will. That, yeah, certainly if your life is out of control, if your landlord's saying, I'm going to kick you out, and your boss is looking at you like he's going to fire you tomorrow, you feel uncomfortable, you feel anxiety. But spiritual practice, and that doesn't mean you have to meditate or be super religious, but there are other studies that show that mindfulness creates greater well-being, better relationships, better health, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Further studies show that if you add compassion, now there's two things to do. You're present and your heart is open to the suffering that's present. Then it even accelerates the movement into well-being. And right before COVID, there was a third study at the University of Leeds in England that showed if you add a meditation on emptiness, that it's all just spaciousness in a certain way, that it further accelerates and deepens the movement into well-being. So, I mean, compassion and emptiness aren't really, I'm in control. It's, I'm paying attention enough and I'm seeing how suffering is created that I'm able to open my heart. Cancer does not cause suffering. Divorce does not cause suffering. Resistance to cancer, resistance to divorce is what causes suffering. If you have cancer, you're probably going to have some resistance. But as long as we're thinking that the suffering is created by the external environment, healing isn't going to be happening. Suffering is created by our relationship to what it is that's going on in our lives. And when we really get that suffering is being created by the way we're clinging, and beginning to trust that each of us has a core sense of basic goodness and kindness that's underneath all the conditioning and all the bullshit, then life begins to change in a very beautiful and dramatic way.
You hit it, you found it, and you did reconcile, which I knew you would, because you're an East meets West, science meets spirituality kind of guy. So that was so well said. I want to shift now, Dale, to the third part of your book, applying this to dying, which a lot of my listeners probably don't think about on a regular basis, but it's important. So let's talk about that part of the book.
Okay. Well, the world contemplative religions all say that the time right after physical death is this remarkable time to awaken and see who we are. The Western worldview is that Dr. Richard, you and me, Dale, and everybody listening, were separate perceiving devices, perceiving an objective, solid reality out there. And in fact, the Western medical model is based on that's the way things are. Ancient tantric wisdom says it's completely the opposite of that. And that view has been lately mathematically proven by quantum mechanics, that there's not a solid, objective reality out there in the way we usually think of it. That there's, instead of reality coming into us, there's one consciousness flowing through us, individual filters creating reality. Now, that might sound theoretical, but the more you kind of feel into that, it's very relaxing and comforting and allowing us to surrender into the moment. So what I'm suggesting here is that something survives death. Consciousness survives death. Whether you believe in heaven and hell or reincarnation or Shirley MacLaine or whatever kind of worldview you have, I don't really care. But because that's all philosophy. But that the way we live determines how we die, right? And can we die with, I've been at the bedside of people who are dying with, oh my God, right? And people who are so beautiful. In fact, with very few exceptions, the most beautiful Westerners I've ever been around are people who are almost dead because they're willing to be themselves. They're not busy saying, do I look good today? Or am I doing this well enough? No, it's just like radiantly, here I am, buddy. Here it is, right? So there is a lot of stuff in the book about here are exercises to support somebody who's dying or to be a better caregiver or what happens when you die in a non-religious language, if you will. I really look at caregiving as not helping another person, but work on yourself. That you're at the bedside of somebody who's dying. And to the extent that you're saying, oh, they're dying and I'm not, and I'm here to help them, all that duality is making it a little bit harder for that person. To the extent that you're working with the stuff that's coming up in you, you're mindful of, compassionate toward the place where I'm trying to do better or here I am, just being with that, then you're connected with that person. You're the best caregiver because you're dealing with your stuff. To the extent you're out there trying to fix it, you're missing those signals. So it's really, in a way, almost like meditating in the context of being at the bedside of somebody who's dying. And then beyond that, a big chunk of this is about grief. Everybody is grieving. Even if you haven't had anybody close to you die recently or ever, grief is not just, I'm sad because somebody died. Grief is all the difficult emotions that arise when we feel separate. The great poet Rumi said, grief can be the garden of compassion. Compassion is the connected heart. Grief is the separate heart. So can we begin to transmute the separateness of grief into the connectedness of compassion? And we've lost part of our childhood dream. People have disappointed us. We've disappointed ourselves at times. There's been a lot of separation in life. Everybody's going around with this background grief that we begin to assume is just human nature, that sense of separation from each other is something we just have to deal with. And that is profoundly sad. In fact, the Tibetans have this beautiful saying, Tibetan Buddhists, that compassion is a mixture of sadness and joy. We're sad because they're suffering, but there is a joy that transcends happiness and sadness because the heart is open. So can we look at what's going on right now today in the world, war in Iran, in Ukraine? Anyway, there's a lot of stuff to react to out there, right? And can we still keep our heart open? Can we feel the suffering of how many people in this moment are being raped, who are starving to death? How many mothers there are watching their children starve and their breasts are dried up because they can't eat themselves? All this is going on every moment of every day, profoundly sad, and can we be joyful? The Dalai Lama is one of the most joyful people I've ever met, and he full well knows what's happening to the Tibetan people through the Chinese occupation, right? So it takes work for most of us to remain joyful. There's a great quote by the poet Wendell Berry. He said, be joyful, though, although you've considered all of the facts. Okay. It's like, can we do that? And it's not easy. Takes work, takes practice, takes play.
I like the way you frame that, though. Takes work, takes play. Dale, I have loved our conversation so much, every moment of it, and I'm so grateful you spent time with us today. As you know, I wrap up every episode by asking my guests just this one question, and that is, what is your biggest helping that one most important piece of information you'd like somebody to walk away with after hearing our conversation today?
That the fact that you and I and everybody we're ever going to meet is mortal, that everybody's going to die. Can that inspire us to be kind to each other, particularly to be kind to ourselves, to forgive ourselves, to realize that we are loved, we are love, to take care of each other, to take care of the planet? Simple stuff. But as long as we don't really admit our mortality, as long as we think we're going to die, that we're not going to die. I mean, one wise man said, the most amazing thing in the world is that everybody's going to die, yet almost everybody lives as if they were immortal. Remembering that we're mortal, can that inspire us to be kind to each other and be kind to ourselves?
Well said. The book is How to Live So You Can Die Without Fear. That's available everywhere tomorrow, and we're going to have a link to that in the show notes. If somebody wants to learn more about you and the work you're doing, Dale, where can they go?
They can go to our website, livingdying, livingdying.org. Write an email to info@livingdying.org. Website, email. I got a bunch of stuff on YouTube. I have a wonderful podcast. Plug my own podcast here. There's something called the Be Here Now Network. BeHereNowNetwork.com. And my channel there is called Healing at the Edge. There's Ram Dass and Krishna Dass and me and Jack Kornfield and Lama Surya Dass and Alan Watts. Wonderful teachers there. I have a podcast that comes out regularly there. There's 150 podcasts of all the stuff I've talked about, but in much, much more depth than what we've had the chance to talk about in the 40 minutes or so that we've been together.
Well, perfect. Well, we will link to all that in the show notes at drrichardschuster.com so that anybody listening to this who wants to take a really deep dive can do so. So we'll make sure we do that. But Dale, what a treat today. Thank you so much for honoring us with your presence. It was a great conversation.
Thank you so much, Dr. Richard. Keep up the good work. It's been a pleasure.
I appreciate that. And I appreciate each and every one of you. If you like what you heard, if you're inspired, if you're going to be mindful to take care of yourself and those around you, go give us a follow and a 5-star review on the podcast app of your choice, because this is what helps other people find the show. But most importantly, go out there today and do something nice for somebody else, even if you don't know who they are, and post in your feeds using the hashtag MyDailyHelping, because the happiest people are those that help others.